Yeah. Morning, everybody. Hi. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower. It's Friday, and all the great features on our Friday show will be coming up, including Fly Jams, Friday Straight Outta Context, Nick D Show, Spies, and You Big Dummy, and more. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text. Check us out on Facebook and Twitter. What's the temperature like in your room, Dan?
Comfortable?
It's like 14 degrees in here. It's really cold in here, and it's normally very comfortable, but for some reason I feel like I'm in space. See, I was going to use that as a segue because I'm a professional broadcaster, Dan, as you know.
Impressive.
Yeah. Dumont studies this show. I want you to know that. Anyway, it's cold in here, man. It's unusual. Geez. All right. Well, my first guest is Rod Pyle, who's an award-winning author. He's a journalist and he's a commentator on space. We love to have him on. And we got a bunch of news involving the world of space to talk to Rod about. Rod, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Good morning.
Morning. How are you?
I'm good. And I'm not cold.
No, and isn't it cold in space?
I've heard that, but not in Pasadena, apparently.
Well, give everybody your background, and you were one of those guys, one of space geek guys, and wanted to be an astronaut, all that cool stuff, and you went on to do some great stuff. So tell everybody your background.
I got a cop to it. I was born in the late 50s and grew up during the space race, and by the time I was in my early teen years, we had great big rockets thundering off to the moon about every 2 months for 3 years, which was an amazing thing. So that was really something you could get wrapped up in. So I got very interested. I gave up the astronaut thing pretty early because you got to look in the mirror one morning and say, no, you're not going to be an astronaut. but I was interested in science, so I did a lot of science at college, but ended up getting more interested in telling the stories instead of actually doing the science because there's a lot of people that are very good at that, and I didn't really think I was going to be one of them. So that's where I went. And it's been television documentaries and now books and journalism for 20, 30 years now. And it's just, I can't imagine having more fun and getting paid for it.
It's pretty great to have a job that you love, isn't it?
It is.
I mean,
and not enough people get to do that.
I know, that sucks. We're lucky. We're lucky guys. I'm grateful every single day I wake up that I have a job that I love. But it's fun to do that kind of stuff. And you have an endlessly fascinating job. Pylebooks.com is the website. P-Y-L-E. Pylebooks.com is the website. Before we get to some of the latest space news, Rod,
yeah.
You got a couple of books on the horizon here. Tell everybody about what the latest ones are.
I do, thanks. I have one coming up in August called Mars Making Contact, and it's sort of the return of the picture book. For a few years there, we weren't doing picture books because they're very expensive and the market was changing and all that stuff, but now it's back. So it's got 300 pictures in it, and it's the story of Mars from the first looks of ancient people, but up through the current space missions. Mostly it's concentrating on American space missions to Mars, because really Mars has been an American story. The Europeans have been there for a while. The Indians just sent something up a few years ago, but the Soviet Union didn't have much luck. The Russians haven't had much luck, so that's a big American story.
Mm-hmm.
And then I've got another book coming out called Blueprint of a Battle Star.
Now, what's this, man?
This is scientific explanations for cool sci-fi stuff. So,
cool.
Give me
some examples. Yeah.
Traveling speed of light, flying cars, invisibility, immortality, all those kinds of things. So sort of like a slightly downscale Michio Kaku. I'm not Michio Kaku, so I write for a slightly different audience.
Yeah.
But it's meant to be fun and informative and really just look at the stuff that we see all the time. How do you build a lightsaber? Because the problem with laser beams is you turn them on and they want to keep going forever.
That's right.
So as it turns out, it's really hard to make it stop when it's about 4 feet long and cut things in half. But there are things that come close. So that's what we talk about, and it was really a lot of fun. And that's coming out about the same time.
That's awesome. A blueprint for a battle star. Now, do you have like specific movies that you kind of deconstruct or talk about how that technology can be done?
Yeah, it's really more about the tech, but for instance, obviously, if you're going to talk about shields and faster than light and ray guns and that kind of thing, you have to talk about Star Trek and Star Wars.
Sure.
You're going to talk about lightsabers, whose copyright that is.
Right, yeah.
Star Wars and Disney, and if you're going to there is a chapter about what it would really take to build a Death Star, and it something like the industrial output of metal on the planet for 850,000 years or something. So, you know, it's the story of the unlikely, but it was an awful lot of fun to do.
That's great. That always reminds me whenever you know, like you're talking about what it would be like to build a Death Star. It always reminds me of that scene in Clerks where they talk about whether or not the guys in the union who were there to build, why they had to die. You know, when they in Jedi, when they blew up the Death Star, and they talked about the construction guys that were there, and and you ever think about how many people were murdered who were innocent? They were just there because they were helping to build the Death Star.
Well, but if they're part of the bad guys, then how can they be innocent? Well, except for the guy in the new movie who turns, right? I
mean, right. Yes.
Gotta go with him. I finally saw that 2 days ago.
What did you think?
Oh, I thought it was great fun. You know, it's interesting to see. I think this was only the second movie that Lucas didn't direct, right?
No. It's the third. Because he didn't direct Empire, he didn't direct Jedi, he directed the three prequels and the first one.
Who directed Jedi?
Richard Marquand directed Jedi. Irvin Kershner directed Empire.
Number two. Okay, yeah. I remember that. I should probably whisper this, but I like the ones that Lucas didn't direct a little better.
No, you shouldn't whisper it.
But I thought this was really well handled, and you know, the effects didn't feel like they were being machine gunned on to me like they did in the last couple I saw. This really, you know, Abrams, God bless the man. I don't think he can walk in water, but he seems to be able to do just about anything else he puts his hands on, and pretty astonishing. It was good.
Well, you know, one of the things you mentioned, the effects, Rod, and one of the reasons why I think the effects are so great and have such a difference in Force Awakens is that, yes, there is a lot of CGI in it, but there are also giant sets. Like, they constructed spaceships, and those were real places in the desert that they went to. They weren't CGI creations like the prequels were. Like, there were, like, no practical effects. There was nothing, you know, no special effects that were built or miniatures that actually existed. All of it was computer-generated, and it had an artificial feel to it. This had kind of a realistic feel to it, as realistic as you can get in a sci-fi movie.
You know, I got out of visual effects just when they were transitioning to heavy CGI, and we talked before about, you know, missing the miniatures and all that kind of stuff, because that was an awful lot of fun to play with the big expensive toys. But it was a really great thing when they finally began to figure out how to do organic effects. And I think for me, the first time I really saw that was in Titanic, when James Cameron figured out, okay, I'm going to pay these guys whatever it takes to make the water on the bow of the Titanic at 26 knots or whatever it was traveling look like water, and to make the smoke coming out of the stacks look like smoke instead of brown smudges, you know.
Yeah.
So that was really, for me, the beginning of understanding how to do it so it looked organic. And I thought, you're right, you know, the way they married the physical props and the visual effects in this movie were extraordinary. Granted, I didn't see it on a big screen, but that Interstellar was another one that was almost all physical miniatures. The only CGI sequence was that launch in the beginning. The rest of them were great big miniatures on great big sound stages, and that's expensive work.
It is, and you know, Interstellar is one of my favorite movies of the past 5 years. I love that movie. And I don't know if we have talked about it in the past about the science of that movie. It's a little out there, but
some of it. But you know, overall, it was pretty solid. I mean, you can't have Kip Thorne, professor at Caltech, on your advisory committee without having it be pretty straight up.
And, yeah.
You know, same with The Martian. I mean, they got really close. They had Jim Green from NASA, who did a great job of helping them figure it all out. And where they did depart from the straight science, like in the beginning with the windstorm, they did it knowingly because you have to have that great inciting incident.
Yeah.
Talk about that. But it worked.
You know, it's what's really – we've got to take a break here for the news, Rob, but very quickly. A couple of weeks ago, we had a guy on the show who is going to eat nothing but potatoes for a year in order to lose weight. And he said,
Jared, by any chance?
No. He's going to eat nothing but potatoes. And so I asked him, of course, if he's seen The Martian, and he hadn't. But said that's the most frequently asked question that he's gotten doing publicity.
Well, if he ends up looking like Matt Damon, he's a lucky man.
Absolutely right. Okay, Rod, hang on. Okay, man.
You bet.
We got a lot of space news to get to, and Rod's going to talk to us about that as well. Rod Pyle is with us. We'll take a break for the news coming up after this. Morning. Hi, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. I'm your overnight dude. Here till 5 o'clock, Steve Grzanich with the opening bell at 5. and my main man, the best, Steve Cochran, at 6. Phone number is 312-981-7200. Fly James Friday coming up later on in the 4 o'clock hour. And we've got Straight Out of Context, Nick D Show, Spies, You Big Dummy. All our regular Friday features are coming up. Right now, Rod Pyle is my guest. He's an award-winning author, a journalist, and is a commentator on space. Pylebooks.com is the website, P-Y-L-E, pylebooks.com. And we have a link on our Facebook page if you'd like to check it out, facebook.com/Nick D Show. And we welcome Rod back to the show. Hi, Rod.
Hey.
All right. So, you know, the first thing we wanted to talk about was SpaceX nailing it. Correct, Rod?
Man, did they ever.
And we've got the video. Tell everybody the story. And if everybody wants to check out the video, we posted it on our Facebook page. So tell everybody the story about what's going on here.
Well, as you know, they've been flying for a number of years, and they've been, on the large, very successful in terms of getting cargo up to the space station and also launching satellites. They have contracts with NASA to deliver that cargo, to bring back trash and various experiments from the space station. And now they also have a contract to start delivering astronauts within a few years, probably two, so that we won't have to rely on the Russians for those very expensive rides we've been buying from them, because his whole a launch with him right now with SpaceX is about the same price as it costs to put one guy in a seat in the Russian Soyuz. It'll be a little more expensive when he's flying people because of various factors, but it'll still be a way better deal than what we're paying now. Mm-hmm. And we're back into American rocket. So, you know, Musk has really pulled off something remarkable in just about a decade. So as we've all seen, he's tried these barge landings again and again, met with failure after failure, but got close. And, you know, the press called it a failure, but getting a rocket from 100 miles plus out in space that's moving at these speeds down to the point that it's moving at about 5 miles an hour vertically and landing anywhere is quite an achievement. So a couple months back, he managed to land it in Florida at the launch site. But what he really wanted to do was get these barge landings going for two reasons. One, in California coastline, where he's launching out of Vandenberg Air Force Base for military payloads and polar payloads, he needs to be able to land at sea because he hasn't got clearance to land on the coastline yet. That's just a Coastal Commission EPA thing. In Florida, the reason he is so desirous of using these barges is it takes twice as much fuel to turn around and come all the way back to the launch site than does be able to land downrange on an ocean barge. So that's really the big motivating factor to do this. And he finally did it. It was a thing of beauty.
And we've got the video up on our Facebook page. You've obviously seen it. Can you describe a bit of it, what it's like?
Well, you know, the crowd over in Hawthorne was watching this at the SpaceX plant, and they got very quiet as it was coming down. And then they saw it enter the frame. And so here's the barge pitching in what looked to me to be about maybe 6 foot 12 out in the Atlantic. And here comes the rocket at the top of frame, and it's moving at kind of a wanky angle. You know, you're looking at it thinking, that's not moving vertically. It's coming down at a slight tilt. And at the very last second, it reorients itself, boosts the rockets up a little higher to slow down for that final few feet before it touches down. And there's a video that's not in the clip I sent you that they gave out later that actually shows the view looking down the side of the rocket with those little, they're fins, but they look like spatulas that are up at the top of the rocket.
Yeah.
That are twitching back and forth to guide the airflow to orient the top of it. At the last second, they lurch over to one side, and the rocket rights itself, and it's set right down the pad. And although this is really a small thing, for some reason it struck me as very cool. Once it's on the barge, and they've got everything safe to make sure there's no chemicals or anything they got to worry about, they send a crew out there to weld the landing legs to the barge so they make sure it doesn't go anywhere without towing it home.
Yeah. Yeah, and the reaction, I mean, people just went nuts.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, you know, Elon Musk being Elon Musk, now that he's done this, it's like, okay, I know that was hard. I know it won't always work, but I've conquered that. So what I really want to do is get the rockets to the first stage to land on the barge, refuel them, and then have them fly themselves back to Florida.
Oh, man.
Have to haul them to the barge. And that's just, it's almost hubris, but you got to love the guy.
Yeah. Now, what's his background? For people who might not know, what's Musk's background?
Well, he's South African, and he was a big part of PayPal. And when that got sold, he took that money and started a number of ventures, one of them being SpaceX, another being Tesla, and another, of course, he's big into solar panels and solar power,
right,
and batteries. So these are some of the various business enterprises he's doing, and he's doing them very well. You know, they're not making a ton of money yet, but they're all working, and the fact that he can keep them functioning, and admittedly, SpaceX is getting money from government contracts, as all the American aerospace companies always have, but he put a couple hundred million of his own dollars into it to get that going and design that rocket and fly it and made sure it worked, and it worked, and to be able to prove that he could do this. And that's something that you don't see very often. The only other person really doing that right now is Jeff Bezos over at Blue Origin, the Amazon owner. And he's doing it with a smaller rocket with suborbital flights very quietly. That's been a much less public story.
Mm-hmm. You know, you must be, because of this being your passion, Rod, you must be thrilled when billionaires and big-time business guys devote money and time, you know, to these enterprises, don't you think?
Well, I am, and growing up when I did, like a lot of people, I was a little distressed in watching the space program slow down. I mean, we had the shuttle. It worked. It was a little dangerous, but it did its job. It got us this beautiful space station that we're still using. So a lot of good came out of that, but it was a very the Nixon administration slashed that budget, and it was a very compromised design, and we've been stuck in low Earth orbit for 35 years. So it's nice to see things moving along. At least in NASA's end of things, it will eventually get us to Mars. And in September, Musk has said he's going to announce his Mars plans. And that's kind of been the big hairy gorilla in the room. We know that NASA intends to go there about 2035. Musk has been saying for years, this is all great, but what I really want to do is go to Mars. And he's got plans to build this Mars Colonial Transporter rocket, which is going to make the one he's got now look like a dwarf and all this. So we're just dying to know what his plans are and what his timetable is.
Wow. Now, you're talking about going into the past. Everybody at this point is the concentration is hugely on Mars. But there are guys like Jim Lovell and the guys who have been to the moon who say we should return to the moon first before going to Mars. And that seems to be a popular opinion. Where do you stand on that, and what's the latest?
I agree, and I've agreed for a long time. The three choices are, there's four choices. We stay at Earth orbit doing what we're doing now at the pace we've been doing it, which is incremental but slow. Or we go back to the moon, build a base probably, not just on the surface, but you can also build them at these things called the Lagrange points, which are these points in space where an object will stay more or less permanently in one spot without a lot of correction. It just stays there. And learn about working between the Earth and the moon, where we're fairly close to home base if we have issues, and it doesn't take quite as much oomph to get out there before heading off on that multi-month journey to Mars. The other option, of course, is no, let's just get the Mars rocket put together and go get it done. So there's been a lot of discussion about this. Various people in the community have different opinions. I missed one, which is the asteroid redirect, which is NASA's official course right now. Before they go to Mars, they want to lasso this asteroid, bring it back by the moon, and have astronauts visit it. A lot of people feel like that can be done with an unmanned spacecraft, and we really don't need to be using the Orion capsule and the SLS mega booster to do that. So there's a lot of impetus, and with the administration change, it'll be interesting to see what happens to go back to the moon. So Lovell was at this ceremony at the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum last week, and he said, I really favor going back to the moon. I've been there. I get it. I know what's going on. I haven't been real thrilled with what I've seen since the Apollo program wound down, although, he's a fan of the shuttle, but he would have liked to have seen that kind of reach and that kind of stretch continue and the benefits that come from it. Mm-hmm. So he's very much a proponent of going back to the moon, and he's a guy you listen to, along with Buzz Aldrin and many others.
What happens if does that delay Mars a lot if they decide to concentrate on going back to the moon?
Well, that's one of those longer discussions. It might delay it some. You got a set amount of money that you got to spend somewhere. We're not ready to go to Mars yet. There's a lot of propulsion work to be done. Life support's been pretty well worked out on the space station, but there's still work to be done on that. One of the big factors is radiation and microgravity. We just had Scott Kelly spend his year in space, so we're getting better and better ideas of what happens to the human body when it's weightless for that period of time. But once you go outside the Van Allen belts, which are still the magnetosphere, which is protecting the space station, now you really got to worry about radiation from the sun, radiation from outside the solar system. And there are ways to deal with it, but you've got to have water jacketing or something to shield the spacecraft. So these are things that need to be worked out, and the moon's certainly a good laboratory to do it. So unless you're going to do an Apollo-style dash to Mars, have your time there and then turn around and come home and call it a day, if you're going to really try and build an infrastructure, you need to start building things in Earth orbit and in lunar orbit to really support this, where you've got fuel depots, you can extract fuel and breathable oxygen from the moon. There's water there in the soil and so forth. So there's all kinds of good reasons to go there.
Mm. Okay. All right, Rod, hang on, okay?
You bet.
All right, Rod Pyle is with us, and you can check out pylebooks.com. We have a link on our Facebook page, and if you want to see that video, it's really pretty cool. You can check it out on our Facebook page at facebook.com/NickDShow. More with Rod coming up right after the break. Morning, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Live in the Allstate Studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower. All righty then. Rod Pyle is my guest. He is an award-winning author, a journalist. He's a commentator on space. Got a couple of new books coming out. And he joins us periodically to talk about all the latest space news. Rod, welcome back.
Thanks.
Hey, before we get to the next story, have you seen the movie Midnight Special?
No.
Okay. Have you heard about it?
No.
It's a smaller movie. Michael Shannon is in it, and it's a science fiction ish kind of movie about a kid who may or may not be from this planet, and the father who knows that the kid has special powers and is on the run from the government and a religious cult to get this kid back. And there are some science fiction moments in it. And some moments of science that I would love to hear your thoughts on. So mark that one down.
Yeah, well, you know, you get much cooler tickets than I do.
Well,
probably because I don't get any. But that sounds like a great. Was it made this year?
Yeah, it's out now. It should be in theaters now. It's playing here in Chicago at a few theaters. I mean, again, it's not a blockbuster by any stretch of the imagination. It's not a huge budgeted movie. Although I will say this. Why am I blanking on Rilo's name, the actor's name? Adam Driver. Adam Driver from Force Awakens is in it.
Ah.
So there's that. Okay. And Michael Shannon, who played Zod in the Superman movie, is in it.
Oh, man.
So it does have a little credential in that regard. And the guy who wrote and directed is a really terrific. I think he's one of the most exciting American filmmakers alive today, a guy named Jeff Nichols. But mark down Midnight Special. I'd really... because the movie's full of amazing ideas, and I'd really be interested on your input on that.
Great. Okay. Next time.
All right, let's talk about the National Space Society.
Yeah, this is a group I've been involved with off and on for, gotta admit it, I guess 30 years or so.
Okay.
And it was set up in 1975. The Apollo was winding down, and Wernher von Braun was involved in it, which... if you're going to have a startup credential, that's a pretty good one to have. And, you know, their goal is to get the public engaged in a public campaign the way that NASA can't do it. You know, they've got limited funds and a charter that only allows to do certain things. This is NASA for outreach and promotion and so forth. But groups like the NSS, and there's a bunch of them, can really put the word out there and get people engaged and so forth. So they worked with one of our California congressman, a guy named Dana Rohrabacher, recently to put together this bill. Let me see if I get the name for it. The Space Exploration Development and Settlement Act of 2016. They always have a lot of words in those titles.
Right.
And the idea is really just, you know, NASA's direction and goals, at by no fault of theirs, get pushed around every time we get a new administration coming in. So, you know, Obama came in, and not to settle politically on one side or the other, but that was the end of the Constellation program, which had its issues. But that was our 2004 George Bush plan to return to the moon, land on the moon, get something going there. Now they shut that down. Now we're going to go out and do the asteroid thing. That's fine, but every time you cancel one of those missions, it costs billions of dollars to shut it down because you got to stop the assembly lines, pay off the contractors, all that kind of stuff. So this isn't good. So they're trying to bring some continuity to the process. The idea is that this bill, which, as I said, the NSS consulted on along with the congressman, and I'll just read a very short thing here, to require the National Aeronautics and Space Administration to investigate and promote the exploration and development of space leading to human settlements beyond Earth and for other purposes. This is really the first clarifying language of that kind that's been put in there, assuming everything goes the way they want it to, since they founded NASA in 1958. So So it will take a few of these kinds of things to really make a difference. But this, I think, will help NASA be able to stay on the rails and get done what they want to do. And that's an exciting thing. If people want to check it out, they've got a website called nss.org.
Well, now, what's the next step for this? Now that they've, you know, they've worded this thing, what's the next step?
Passing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then really being implemented. I mean, whatever administration comes in, they're going to have their own set of plans, their own set of priorities. There'll probably be a new NASA administrator. Usually when there's a new president, the current administrator goes and a new one comes in. At least that's been the pattern. So, you know, depending on who wins the election, it could go one direction or another. We all remember poor Newt Gingrich when he said, you know, I'd support the idea of a lunar colony, and he got skewered and sort of drummed out of the room, and a lot of people think that that cost him his run at the presidency. So you got to be careful what you're going to suggest and what you're going to come up with, but hopefully it'll be a little more emphasis on what I just talked about and really moving ahead on the Moon-Mars thing.
You know, in recent years, what administrations have been the kindest to NASA in space exploration?
Well, that's an interesting one because it was started under Eisenhower, which is a Republican administration, and he was a little reluctant, but he said, okay, I can see where this is going to do some good. Kennedy comes into office, you know, he makes the big moon speech. He wasn't really that interested in space, as near as anybody can tell, but he knew it was a smart thing to do politically, and he needed it as bad as they needed him.
Right.
So that was the big start. Johnson was a believer, promoted it heavily, pushed it. 68, he's out. Nixon comes in. He's not a big fan. Agnew was, but as you may remember, Agnew didn't have a whole lot of horsepower. And under Nixon, it began to really get trimmed down and minimized. What was left of the Apollo hardware flew with Skylab and the Apollo-Soyuz project to link up with the Russian spacecraft in orbit. But it began to slow down. The budgets began to suffer. Since then, I think probably, Reagan was a supporter, although a lot of that money that could be used for that was going into the Strategic Defense Initiative or Star Wars,
right.
So that gobbled up quite a bit. George Bush Sr., fairly active supporter, and then it kind of began to dwindle. I think Bush Jr. really did intend for things to go better than they did with his 2004 speech about going back to the moon with the Constellation program, but it just never got funded to the extent that it needed to be. And by the time I got looked at in 2008, 2009 by the Augustine Commission, it was pretty clear they weren't going to make the hurdle. So they were going to have to make a choice. And the choice was to refocus on what we're doing now.
Interesting. Interesting stuff. Before we let you get out of here, there is an additional story that lasers can hide Earth from deadly aliens.
Yeah.
Can you care to make a comment on this headline?
Well, you know, it's interesting because we're kind of all over the map on this. We got Stephen Hawking saying, hey, you know, let's not be so anxious to contact the aliens. They may not like us. And then just a week or two ago, he came out with the Russian billionaire saying, well, on second thought, let's set up this breakthrough initiative and we'll send a fleet of microprobes out to Alpha Centauri and say hi. So there's a little bit of modulation there. The idea, these are two guys from the UK who said, or it was published in the UK, I think it was an American university, who said, you know, the way we find planets around other stars is to look at that star until we see a little dip in the amount of light coming from it, and then we assume that a planet's moved between us and that star, probably in its own solar system, and that's what's causing that dip in light. And if we can see them, they can see us, and maybe we don't want them to see us. So if we get a big enough laser and shine it in that direction, it'll make up for the light that dips from the sun,
okay,
and you won't be able to spot us.
And save us from the evil aliens.
Well, maybe. But we're talking great, big, big, big lasers, and they got to be on for quite an amount of time. So it's a project you're really going to have to be in love with if you're going to make it happen.
Just in time for the Independence Day sequel. Yeah.
Yeah. Isn't that going to be great? Okay. Now that's one I'm going to go see that first day.
Okay. All right. Well, have a good time on that one. I'm not a fan on the first one. I also love the fact that, like, I didn't like the first one at all, but I also thought it was kind of hilarious that they were Apple compatible. They were Mac compatible, the aliens. That's kind of
helpful. Yeah, well, at least it wasn't. What was that one, Signs, where it turns out that the aliens come to the Earth, which is 4/5 water, but
right,
it destroys them?
Right, and that movie was so terrible. It's like they're supposed to be these really intelligent life forms. They go to a planet, 75% of it can kill it. And
nothing.
And the Mel Gibson had to remember his wife's final last words was swing away, so he hit an alien with a baseball bat. Stupidest
movie, isn't it?
So ridiculous. Rod, always a good time talking to you, man. Fascinating stuff. People can check out the video that you sent us on our Facebook page, pilebooks.com, and we'll talk to you soon, Rod. Always a pleasure.
Thanks. Take care, Nick.
All right, man. Take care. It's Rod Pyle, everybody. Check out pilebooks.com. We have a link on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Nick D Show. News is next.